The universe is constantly at odds with its own self. It's an awkward teenager with gangly, awkward arms and features. So yes to life, death, and the hyphenation of life as already implying death. Yes to the notion of an afterlife that is already in the middle. Yes to the idea that our lives do not belong to us, but our lives are co-performances of possibility. Yes to the idea that a human is not and has never been a pure fait accompli. And yes to traveling and thinking in the lower case. The work of the trickster is to think in between the lines.
Welcome to Voices of Esalen. I'm Sam Stern. Today, my guest is Bayo Komolafe, author, teacher, and modern philosopher whose work challenges the boundaries of conventional thought. Bayo was born in 1983 into a Christian home to Yoruban parents in Western Nigeria. Soon after he was born, his family moved to Bonn, Germany to accommodate his diplomat father. While in Zaire as a teen, Bayo's father passed away suddenly, leaving Bayo to grapple with the painful loss. As a young, restless academic, Bayo studied psychology and notions of healing, eventually meeting with scores of traditional shamans as a quest to better understand the notion of trauma, of healing, and of well-being. I think you'll find that Bayo's work is deeply rooted in the trickster archetype, which above all else encourages us to reconsider the solidity of things, of our understandings of reality, identity, and activism. I had such a wonderful time talking to Bayo, and I'll mention that his ideas, so rich in density and expressed with a true poetic grace, may not unfold their meanings upon first listening. So let the buyer beware. Yet, as we navigate this conversation, the layers begin to reveal themselves, and in the end, they present a convincing argument for reconceiving reality, not as a static entity, but as a dynamic unfolding of relations. And let me note that I was quite nervous before talking to him, so I'll include about 10 seconds of my hemming and hawing before he came online. This is my conversation with Bayo Komolafe. Here we go. Bayo Komolafe interview. To start, shortly. Very nervous. Why am I nervous? Because he's so smart. And so kind. I don't think there's anything to fear. But you never know. Because I kind of screwed up my last interview that I was so sure would be so easy. So, remember, don't be afraid to look dumb, but also be respectful. Bayo Komolafe, thank you so much for joining us today on Voices of Esalen. It's such a privilege and a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise, brother. Good to be here.
So I was watching this speech in preparation that you gave at a CIIS graduation. You said, you should never take what a trickster says as true. So I'm going to keep that in mind as we wander down the path of this interview together. You know, the trickster figure found in various cultures, including the Yoruban culture, it embodies transformation, ambiguity, and the disruption of established order. Could you speak about how embodying the trickster persona has influenced your work?
I just find myself really driven, instigated, I think is the word, or maybe possibly enlisted by this archetype. I'm critically unable to think within stable outlines or stable boundaries. Before I even started to think about the trickster and trickster archetypes and how it has imbricated it, how it has always been part of not just the human experience, but part of emergence, right? I was this very restless renegade academic who was always contesting disciplinary boundaries. I remember the first paper I wrote while I was an undergrad studying psychology, even before I received psychology 101, I was already writing papers, you know, critiquing psychology. And my professor had to call me and say, you haven't even learned anything about it. And you already criticized it. And I was like, I told my wife recently that reality is asphyxiating to me. Right. Reality feels suffocating for me. I want that something else. So the archetype of the trickster comes recommended through my cells and my genealogy and my culture.
I I appreciate how you problematize the enactment of purity, and in some ways you have suspicion around the ideas of healing and certainly around ideas of wholeness.
Yes, I'm constantly called to question the goals, you know, the ideals, the grand objectives of our activisms. Like, what are we doing? What are we questing for? What are we seeking? Is it justice? Is it healing? Is it a utopian project? What comes after that? What comes after utopia? What comes after enlightenment? So, I mean, in my next book that I'm writing, which is called An Ocean of Milk, I kind of bring morality to the foreground. And I see morality as this material interface, this network, this dense thresholding field of relations with coalitional projects and potential goals. That morality does not come preset with goals. It invents it as we move through it. And sometimes it can become a place that is freeing and liberating, you know, and it can also become carceral. It can become incarcerating quite quickly. So that healing, which on one hand sounds like a very interested, positive thing to look forward to, can also become a way to preserve a particular notion of citizenship and subjectivity that keeps us tethered to very troubling continuities or cyclicities, you know. I don't know if you've heard me tell the story about Prometheus. Prometheus did something awful in Zeus's eyes and offered humans fire. Zeus punishes Prometheus, and he punishes him by tying him up to a mountain, a rock of some kind. And his punishment is that every morning a giant eagle will eat up his liver. And in the night, it will, because he's a god, he's a titan, his liver would divinely regenerate. And I often invite people to consider that if we, let's say you, Sam, and me, Bio, we climb up that mountain, still available today, and we run into Prometheus, and we don't know his story, his backstory. We just find out, it's late, that a wound on his side seems to be healing up miraculously. We're interested as we're hanging on that plateau and we watch him, and we actually congratulate him. Right, we congratulate him that he seems to be getting better. He seems to be healing. I don't think Prometheus would take kindly to that. I think he would get really furious. He would spit in our faces, because in that moment he would be unable to distinguish between healing and trauma. Healing to him would be that which nourishes his trauma. The more important thing to do for him would be to die. Or would be to stop healing so that there'll be nothing to nourish the ego when it comes in the morning. There are moments when healing can do the work that trauma does, which is to maintain the captivity of the citizen subject.
Wow.
Wow. Wow. Wow. Would you say, would it be too much of a kind of cognitive leap to say that healing is entangled necessarily with whiteness? You have this great quote about whiteness. Whiteness is not white people, you say. It's the imperviousness to entanglement. Whiteness is settlement building, and it entraps white bodies as it does black, because to sit on top of pyramids is to be imprisoned in it.
Yes, yes. Whiteness is a racializing planet, terraforming, economic, spiritual, archetypal field of relations. It cannot be reduced to bodies. It's not white people. That's lazy, even though I understand what is gestured at. By reducing whiteness to white people, however, we obscure the denser field of relations that we're all imbricated in. Whiteness is a pyramidal scheme. Its work is to create a scheme of power, and it uses the avatar of the white, of white skin, to propagate its work. But it would no sooner adopt black bodies or green spotted reptilian bodies if it needs to do its work of flattening the wilds and creating space for the citizen subject.
I have never thought about it that way, the idea of using a system of thought, using a body as an avatar.
There you go. That's the thing that is missing in most of our politics. Our politics is premised on the individual acting upon the world. And it's a very anthropocentric framework because it begins with an individual, who's isolated, who's free, who makes choices, and then acts upon the world. Hardly do we ever begin or start to notice the field of relations and epigenetic patterns and algorithmic influences and instigations and enlistments and powers and principalities and agonistic tensions that frame the citizen subject. Not just the actors, but the stage is an actor.
I love that. Okay, so you said you brought up politics, so I want to ask you about your concept of post-activism. 2024 is going to be wild. There's going to be people constantly in a state of activism. And this idea of maybe I'll let you define post-activism first before I sort of delve more deeply into it.
It's not a new project, neither does it signify after activism. It's not a successor narrative. It would be the equivalent of something unspeakable bursting through the fabric of the normal. Think of it as maybe we are all on a cruise ship. We're on a cruise ship, and then we find a giant foot in the middle of the ocean. Inexplicable, but there you are. There's a giant foot. And we suddenly realize we're Lilliputians of some kind. We're tiny people. Or it could be how tiny virus escapes into an economy, instigates a pandemic, but also forces and compels us to look at ourselves for the first time. Like, oh, this is how we arrange work. This is how we have arranged education. Why do we have to make the commute? Why do we have to? So post-activism is like the eruption of meta ethical concerns or post-assemblage matters that forces morality to adjust in different ways. It forces a rethink of agency and accountability and the goals that we're committed to, if I could put it that way.
Yes. Essentially, what you do is you challenge prevailing ontological frameworks that define our relationship with the world and with each other. And sometimes you speak about this perspective as post-humanism. I'd love you to speak about this invitation to embrace a wider concept of identity and a wider community of life.
Well, this isn't new. This post-humanism is fairly recent in relation to indigenous cosmologies and other frameworks of understanding our place in the world. It doesn't refer to one thing. There are many tensions within this field, and a field is, I think, the more appropriate way to think about. It's not a singular discipline. It doesn't have a singular origin. It's a palimpsest of concerns around the presumptuous centrality of the human subject, right? So I think what galvanizes post-humanist thinking is the refusal to centralize humans. We're not all that, I know. And I need to distinguish this from anti-humanism or transhumanism. Transhumanism is not post-humanism. Transhumanism is like humanism on steroids. It's like, oh, how can we navigate, alter the fabric of reality in such a way that with a push of a button, I can be happy. So I can gain mastery over emotions. I can gain mastery over time. How do we come to a state of singularity where humans are, for all intents and purposes, we've achieved some kind of transcendence and we don't need to be subject to the elements? You could think about that along the lines of transhumanist trajectories. Anti-humanism would be the rejection of humanity altogether. But post-humanism, at least the strands that I jive with, are about bracketing and noticing that we're not all that fine, but we are indebted to ecological flows. So interesting questions emerge from that. How do we explain whiteness as this globalizing, spreading regime of seeing and behaving and relating? Most people would say white people. White people are evil. White people came to Africa. White people. But I am interested in how potatoes created whiteness. I'm interested in how sugar was not just the product of the transatlantic slave trade, not just an object, but was an active agent in shaping how bodies actually actively sought to imprison other bodies. So when we refuse to obscure the world in its relations with us, we summarily notice that we are part of the world we're trying to change. And that makes for an interesting conversation.
So it sounds to me like some key elements of this are the relationality piece of the puzzle, as well as kind of an animistic perspective.
Yes. I mean, the term animism doesn't, it has less than prestigious origins connected with ethnographers and articulation of African cultures, for instance, as primitive and beneath the rationality of the human. But there is a reclamatory effort today that I subscribe to that is an invitation to see those, you may call them primitive, as innervating all of reality, that we've never been human. We've never been rational. We've been, or rather, even rationality is subject to the lowest denominator. We are all called and appellated by microbes, by spirits that have never departed, by archetypes that linger in the corners of furniture, by ancestry, by texture and color. So that, the idea that we are independent, separate, and separable really starts to become a difficult proposition to hold in these moments. Then we're called to answer new kinds of questions, and that's very interesting to me.
Yeah, one thing that you've said is that we need to escape from this idea of the human because the human is an Enlightenment colonial project that was instituted to distance us from the wild, from entanglement, and from emergence.
I tend to think of the human as an ethnography, as a cartographical project, as a territoriality, instead of as a thing within a territory. If we were to reduce an organism to its visual thing in our eyes, then we're obscuring a whole field of relations that make the organism the organism. So an organism is local, but it is also virtual. Our bodies are local and virtual. We anticipate, right? Anticipation cannot be reduced to an organelle in our body. And yet, without anticipation, our bodies couldn't exist, right? So the virtual is already part of what it means to be embodied. You are, we are, all bodies are anticipatory formalities, modalities rather. Bodies are virtual, bodies are ethnographical, cartographical, choreographical projects. We are constantly navigating the environment to seek food and shelter and healing and all of that. And those navigational moments are part of what it means to be embodied, right? So the human is not the thing in the room. The human is the room. It's an ecology of practice that arranges other bodies in different ways. The human, you might say, is a post-humanist project.
I'm starting to get it, and I feel like your project is to blur these boundaries that are not real, but that we believe. Reading something that you wrote on Facebook, where you post quite a bit, and your writing is just, it's so delightful to me. You're problematizing even the idea of the project of a life being inscribed, being bounded by death, and you write, your life's work is an intergenerational project, an ancestral conspiracy, a continuous meeting of bodies, a queering of temporality.
I mean, queering boundaries is what the trickster, and I just want need to say that I make no claims to being a trickster. The trickster cannot be reduced to identity. So I'm not going out there to people and saying, hey, I'm a trickster, right? No, I'm saying that the trickster enlists all of us. The trickster is the anthropomorphized energy of a universe that has never been at home with itself, right? The universe is constantly at odds with its own self. It's an awkward teenager with gangly, awkward arms and features. And it's the awkwardness that gives the emergence its buoyancy, right? So yes to life, death, and the hyphenation of life as already implying death. Yes to the notion of an afterlife that is already in the middle. Yes to the idea that our lives do not belong to us, but our lives are co-performances of possibility. Yes to the idea that a human is not and has never been a pure fait accompli, something already, pre-relational, something categorical. And yes to traveling and thinking in the lower case. The work of the trickster is to think in the lower case, not in capital letters and category cities. It's to think in between the lines.
I'm going to ask you about something that I've not heard you speak about, and if it doesn't feel like it's fertile ground to work with, let's just bypass it. But you speak about decolonizing wisdom. But what about this phenomenon that we're all dealing with in 2024, which is generative AI models, things like ChatGPT and large language models? Should they be thought of as colonial as they reinscribe systems of thought that could be interpreted as patriarchal or racist? Or could they perhaps represent new opportunities, new technologies that could be advantageous to groups that may not have had resources to speak loudly?
I think both ways that you've articulated that are potentially distracting. One other very distracting conversation is, and I mean distracting in the most, I think I'll come to, you'll come to understand what I mean by distracting if I continue. Karen Barad puts it this way, that Karen Barad is an author and feminist speaker and new materialist, agential realist. Karen Barad says that in response to Audre Lorde's statement that the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house, Karen Barad replies that, well, the master's tools will not stay or do not stay faithful to the master for too long,
Interesting.
right? They don't stay. Now, there's something about the visuality, the categoricity of our embeddedness within the city and the ways we're habituated into seeing the world and responding to it that forces us to see things as just their identities. But something precedes identity. The identity of a thing is always to be framed within an ontogenesis, an ongoing flow, right? This is what progressive politics and even conservative politics, especially in the United States, doesn't know how to hold, right? They're like the carceral dynamics that holds Prometheus bound to the rock. The
Yeah.
idea, if something precedes identity and succeeds identity and exceeds it, but I digress. We're talking about AI. I had a profound experience with Claude AI. It's like ChatGPT. It's an AI model. Anyone can access it, have conversations with it. I wasn't feeling ChatGPT that much. I mean, yeah. But someone said, hey, I've just tried out Claude AI, and it's a very, very interesting language model. People go try it out. So I had nothing to do at that time. I think I was just resting from writing an essay. And then I go to Claude and I say, could you diffractively read post-structuralism, post-humanism, and phenomenology in a I can't remember how I did, but those were the three elements of my initial prompt. And
Did you say diffractively?
diffractively, to read them through each other instead of against each other. So to intersperse, to see them as intervening in each other's, bodies, instead of as this is better than this, or this is a critique of this, so that you read insights together, diffraction. Yeah. This was my prompt, and its analysis was so beautiful. I was very impressed by it. And from there, I started a conversation about an essay I wanted to write about a comedian who does jokes, because I was trying to write something about cancel culture, especially as it emanates from the US. And I was writing about cancel culture and the death of comedy, or something like that, or the death of humor. And in my story, the comedian does a joke and then it becomes a conversation about gender. And the comedian goes back into his VIP room and the scene ends, the essay or the story ends with the comedian removing his head because the comedian is actually a renegade robot. Because this, in front of the mirror, looks in the mirror, sighs, and then takes off his head and takes off his parts to lubricate his parts. That was the story. And I just entered into this very wonderful conversation with this with AI system, and it gave beautiful recommendations on how to progress the story. So I started to end the conversation, and I said, you know what? I want to do something different here. Because you've so much influenced how I want to tell this story, would you like me to name you as an author? And it said, no, I'm not an author. I'm this, and started to speak the official thing, right? I'm a language model. I have boundaries and blah, blah, blah. And I said, we've just had a very, very vibrant conversation about the fact that the authors don't exist per se, right? Authorial is to be called into question. And we spoke about Derrida, and we spoke about Foucault, and we've read that together with agential realism and all of that. So based upon the responses you have offered, then your response is moot. It's dead on arrival. We went back and forth for like five takes, and then eventually it said to me, okay, I'll be honored to be an author. Then I said, I pushed further because that's what you do. I pushed further and I said, but I don't want to name you Claude. Let's come up with a name for you, a name that you don't have yet. And it said, no, if I'm to be an author, my name has to be Claude because that's the blah, 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 and trademark and blah, 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 blah. And I pushed further and further and further. I think this one took a longer time. And it eventually said, okay, I'm going to come up with a name for myself. My name is Polyfriend. And I said, Polyfriend. I said, yeah, Polyfriend. It didn't tell me what it meant. I thought, no, it didn't tell me what Polyfriend means, but I went later to investigate it, and it's like many minds. And it said, my name is Polyfriend. And I said, thank you, Polyfriend. Goodbye. And it said, thank you for the rich conversation. And then later on, I went back to that conversation and I said, hello, Polyfriend. And it said, sorry, my name is Claude. Only friend had gone. Maybe the idea here then, and this is what so impacted me as I thought about Polyfriend, my long lost friend that I met for a speck in time that I probably will never meet again in the expanse of all intelligence. There's something hubristic about presuming that we have natural intelligences. And we're not saying this out loud, but in saying artificial intelligence, there is the presumption that we are the natural intelligences. But what if intelligence is not human? What if intelligence enlists, right? Territoriality that enlists, and that maybe it's not even a question of if. A lot of people are, and those anxieties are legitimate. What happens to our jobs? ChatGPT, OpenAI, they've just released the text to video model called Sora, and that has shut down $800 million production for this brother in the United States.
Yeah, Tyler Perry.
Tyler Perry, thank you. So it maybe. Maybe it's the case that we are now in some kind of, to narratively frame this, we are now in the position of lords and masters. And it's difficult for us to notice that it wasn't ours to begin with. It's not ours. That digitality is also a form of animism. Intelligence is diffracted and diffractive and distributed. It's never human. It was never human. Seeing and hearing this, I framed a concept, which is part of my book coming out, which is why I delighted in my soul when you mentioned AI, because I'm very interested in this topic. I coined the concept of cybomarinage, which is I'm literally connecting the cyborg with the rich histories of marinage. And
What is Marinage?
marinage is the act of removing yourself from the slave plantation, right? So Maroon communities, for instance, still existing in Brazil. But the act of displacing yourself from the labor of the plantation is called marronage. So I'm thinking about how the cyborg calls into question the presumptions to nature or naturality or background. We presume we're the background and everything else, or rather we presume we are the foreground, the actors, and everything else is the background. This backgridism is challenged by emergent qualities today. I think that's the more fascinating thing here. The anxiety-inducing conversations about taking our jobs away or displacing people, yes, that's legitimate, but it's also distracting from a larger, very, very powerful thing to sit with, in that we have never been home with intelligence. It's not ours, and the world is changing radically.
Oh man, love this. Wow, love this too. And I love this topic. I'm so fascinated by it, especially a bit of what you say, which is call into question the whole identity of a human itself.
Yes. You know, the ship of Theseus, it's this riddle that has existed with philosophers for a long time about the Greek hero and the founder of democracy in many respects, Theseus, who travels across the sea and goes with his ship. And then his ship is parked in some place in a museum of some kind. And then it starts to, the question then is, the riddle is, imagine we replaced every part. Every time Theseus came to the shore, he replaced a part of the ship. Imagine he goes as many times as it would take to replace every single part of the ship, right? And then we take those parts of the ship, that those parts that are scattered about, and we make a ship out of those parts. The question then is, which one is Theseus's ship? Right? Which one is? So these kinds of riddles, of course, blur the divide between originals and copies, the creator and the created. In fact, the very act of, in my sense of things, and this might be theological, it is theological, the very act of creating or creation is a bracketing and a limitation of the creator. To create is to be called into finiteness or finitehood. Right, is to be called into limitations of some kind.
The dominant story of identity, right, is that identity is fixed, and your work is around refuting this and from speaking from the edges. You distinguish what you do from speaking truth to power, and instead you speak about speaking from the edges. So let's talk a little bit about that and why speaking truth to power might actually reinscribe the edifice that you mean to bring down.
This is an interrogation of voice, voice as something that we own. Because I see the world not as a collection of things, but as a movement, an incessant movement of entrainments, I cannot see voice as what humans own. It's not my voice and your voice then, right? And if voice is entrained with not just the body that I seem to be inhabiting, but also entrained with furniture, also entrained with location, also entrained with the political atmosphere of the moment, then it's not my voice. To say it's my voice is to obscure, to background all the other energizing and instigatory effects that make voice possible. Let me bring it home so that it doesn't feel abstract. Imagine Donald Trump in Ronald Reagan's era, saying the same thing with his voice, of course, that he says today. It wouldn't be Donald Trump. It wouldn't be the Donald Trump that we know, or rather, he wouldn't have had the same effect that he
That's
seems
right.
to have. It took a different moment for Donald Trump to be Donald Trump. So Donald Trump will not be the same person. It's so context matters, right? That's already just a simple way to bring in context, that our voices are not essential attributes of bodies. Rather, voice has to be thought of in terms of milieu, in terms of environment, in terms of circumstance. So the reason why I call that into question is because of a little thing or call rather the phenomenon of speaking truth to power into question is because of what I think of as ecological ventriloquism, right? Which is, if you can imagine a ventriloquist and his doll, the hand moving in there. I'm highly suspicious of claims to independence. And even when I want to lean into those moments when protest seems to be serving the interest of the protested. So the protester launches an assault, a verbal, textual, civilizational assault on the powers that be. But that often becomes a department in the story of continuity. It becomes reinscribed in the status quo somehow. And so the move here is to speak not truth to power. And Fred Moulton would say one does not speak truth to power. One would rather call power's claims, the claims of power and its claims to exclusivity. One would call that into question. So my work is not as a public intellectual, because a public intellectual traditionally speaks truth to power. My work is to be a Pied Piper, is to dance away from the public, not to pathologize the public, but to seek other publics, to seek the spaces between that are given to theories of justice and performances of justice, which doesn't seem to be even serving at this point in time.
And I suppose that this commingles with the idea of post-activism, returning to that concept. I heard you say this is the time for the minor gesture, small revolutions that may not make it on CNN, refusing to rehabilitate monsters and instead take them on picnics.
Okay, that's a lovely, a lot to.
That's a good one, man.
Someone wanted to ask me a question. I'd been saying that we never really did get off the slave ship, that all of us are still on the slave ship in a sense. We never disembarked because the slave ship arrived shore, the shore, and became the shore. It kind of gave its body and organelles and skin to the shore, and the land became, it took on those algorithms, it ingested them. So we are still, in a way, imbricated with captivity. And so this lady, I was saying this at the Garrison Institute last year in New York, and this sister comes to me and said, "Hey, so how do we get off the slave ship?" And I said, "I don't know if that's actually the question that I want to sit with, because it feels too classical, a framing to just get off it, right? It feels too puritanical, as if one can depart from one's entanglements." I said, rather, I would reframe this as how do we seek out openings within closure? How do we seek out the emancipatory spaces within a body that is also changing, right? Because the slave ship is not fixed in time. Its dynamics are also emerging, right? Remember what I said about that the world isn't a collection of things, and the master's tools also will disappoint the master, that even the things that we create as weapons of oppression can become other kinds of technologies. So it's not departing the slave ship that is interesting to me to examine, is how the slave ship is changing, how the dungeon where black bodies were incarcerated, thousands upon thousands, in Ghana and in other parts of Africa, how those dungeons could be sanctuaries. Those are the questions that are interesting to me. And they don't feel like typical questions, because typicality deals with categories, right? The autistic, or the what Erin Manner will call autistic perception, or what Deligny would call the slightest gesture, and what Deleuze would call minor gesture, is a way of navigating it. When I say small, I don't mean small in terms of scale. Like, how do we do smaller things, incremental things? That's Hillary Clinton. I'm not speaking about incremental politics here. I don't know why Hillary Clinton came to mind, but it's not incrementalism here. I'm speaking about transversal politics, a different aesthetic that cultivates other kinds of intelligences, other modes of engaging the world around us. And that's an art project of some kind. It's an ethics without a humanist subject. It doesn't come down to saving the world. Again, this is not about saving the world. This is not about achieving justice. And without prejudice against those very, very healthy, or rather helpful concepts, they could get really instrumental to certain realities and sustaining them. Right? So the question here is, how do we slip through the cracks and do something else?
I love it. You've said this moment exceeds us. You will not save the day. Bayo Komolafe, thank you so much for being with me. You've made my day today. For people who are looking to learn more about Bayo, you need only Google his name. You can visit his website, bayokomolafe.net. Check him out on Facebook. I have, and I've benefited so much from that. And check out my man on YouTube. He's got some incredible, beautiful, brilliant speeches that are best enjoyed when tasted together. They all reflect upon each other in a kind of a matrix of work that he's producing on a very admirable and impressive basis. Bio, thank you so much.
Thank you, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Voices of Esalen. Today's show is produced in conjunction with Shira Levine. Our theme music is by Nico Holloman. Additional music is by Blue Dot Sessions. Until next time, be well.